bull. Have at it! Jean's showing with the blades was even better than his outing with the lash. Maranzala clapped approvingly. That's right! Up through the stomach, under the ribs. Put a foot of steel there and tickle a man's heart with it, and you've just won the argument, son. As he took the matched blades back from Jean, he chuckled. How's that for teeth lessons, eh, boy? Eh? Jean stared at him, puzzled. Haven't you ever heard that one before? Your Kappa Barsavi, he's not from Camor originally. Taught at the Therin Collegium. So when he drags someone in for a talking to, that's etiquette lessons. And when he ties them up and makes them talk, that's singing lessons. And when he cuts their throats and throws them in the bay for the sharks...
Oh, said Jean, I guess that'd be teeth lessons. I get it.
Right. I didn't make that one up, mind you. That's your kind. I'd lay odds the big man knows about it, but nobody says anything like that to his face. That's how it always is, be it cutthroats or soldiers. So, next lovely toy.
Maranzala handed Jean a pair of wooden-handled hatchets. These had curved metal blades on one side and round counterweights on the other.
No fancy name for these skullcrackers. I wager you've seen a hatchet before. Your choice to use the blade or the ball. It's possible to avoid killing a man with the ball, but if you hit hard enough, it's just as bad as the blade. So judge carefully when you're not attacking a woundman.
Almost immediately, Jean realized that he liked the feel of the hatchets in his hands. They were long enough to be more than a pocket weapon, like the gimp steel or the blackjacks most right people carried as a matter of habit, yet they were small enough to move swiftly and use in tight spaces, and it seemed to him they could hide themselves rather neatly under a coat or vest. He crouched. The knife fighter's crouch seemed natural with these things in his hands. Springing forward, he chopped at the wound man from both sides at once, embedding the hatchet blades in the dummy's ribs. With an overhand slash to the wound man's right arm, he made the whole thing shudder. He followed that cut with a backhanded stroke against the head, using a ball rather than a blade. For several minutes he chopped and slashed at the wound man, his arms pistoning, a smile growing on his face.
"Hmm, not bad," said Don Maranzala. "Not bad at all for a total novice, I'll grant you that. You seem very comfortable with them."
On a whim, Jean turned and ran to one side of the courtyard, putting 15 feet between himself and the wound man. The driving rain thrust fingers of grey down between him and the target, so he concentrated very hard, and then he lined up and threw, whipping one hatchet through the air with the full twisting force of his arm, hips, and upper body. The hatchet sank home, blade flat on, in the wound man's head, where it held fast in the layers of leather without so much as a quiver.
"Oh, my!" said Don Maranzala.
Lightning roiled the heavens yet again, and thunder echoed across the rooftop.
"My, yes! Now there's a foundation we can build upon!"
Chapter 10 Teeth Lessons 1. In the darkness beneath the echo hole, Jean Tannon was moving even before the cask came crashing down into the black water, lit faintly from above by the red glow of Barsavi's torches. Beneath the ancient stone cube, there was a network of hanging rafters, built from black witchwood and lashed with elderglass cords. The rafters were slimy with age and unmentionable growths, but they had surely held as long as the stones above had, and they retained their strength. The waterfall that cascaded in from the roof terminated here in one of the swirling channels beneath the rafters. There was a veritable maze of the things. Some were as smooth as glass, while others were as turbulent as whitewater rapids. A few wheels and even stranger devices turned slowly in the corners of the under-rafters. Jean had briefly appraised them by the light of a tiny alchemical ball when he'd settled himself in for a long wait.
Bug, understandably unwilling to move too far from Jean's company, had crouched on a rafter of his own about 20 feet to Jean's left. There were little shafts in the stone floor of the echo hole, square cuts about 2 inches wide, irregularly spaced and serving some unguessable function. Jean had positioned himself between one of these, knowing that it would be impossible to hear any of the activities above with the noise of the waterfall right in his ear. His understanding of the situation above was imperfect, but as the long minutes rolled by, and the red light grew, and Kappa Barsavi and Locke began speaking to one another, Jean's uneasiness deepened into dread. There was shouting, cursing, the trample of booted feet on stone, cheers. Locke was taken. Where was the god's damned bondsmage? Jean scuttled along his rafter, looking for the best way to cross to the waterfall. It would be a good 5 or 6 feet up from the rafters to the lip of the stone gash through which the waterfall poured, but if he stayed out of the falling water, he could make it. Besides, it was the quickest way up, the only way up from within here. In the thin red light pouring down through the little holes in the floor, Jean signalled for Bug to stay put. There was another outburst of cheering above, and then the copper's voice, loud and clear through one of the peepholes, "Take this bastard and send him out to sea!" Send him out to sea? Jean's heart pounded. Had they already cut Locke's throat? His eyes stung at the thought that the next thing he'd see was a limp body falling in the white stream of gushing water, a limp body dressed all in grey. Then came the cask, a heavy dark object that plunged into the black canal at the base of the waterfall with a loud splash and a geyser of water. Jean blinked twice before he realized what he'd just seen. "Oh, gods!" he muttered. Like for like, Barsavi had to be fucking poetic. Overhead there was more cheering, more stomping of feet. Barsavi was yelling something. His men were yelling in response. Then the faint lines of red light began to flicker, shadows passed before them, and they began to recede in the direction of the street door. Barsavi was moving, so Jean decided to take a risk. There was another splash, audible even over the hiss and rumble of the waterfall. What the hell was that? Jean reached beneath his vest, drew out his light globe, and shook it. A faint white star blossomed in the darkness. Clinging tightly to the wet rafter with his other hand, Jean tossed the globe down toward the channel in which the cask would have fallen, about 40 feet to his right. It hit the water and settled, giving Jean enough light to discern the situation. The little channel was about 8 feet wide, stone-bordered, and the cask was bobbing heavily in it, three-quarters submerged. Bug was thrashing about in that canal, visible only from the arms up. Jean's light globe had struck the water about 3 feet to the right of his head. Bug had jumped down into the water on his own. Damn, but the boy seemed to be constitutionally incapable of remaining in high places for any length of time. Jean looked around frantically. It would take him a few moments to work his way over to a point where he could splash down into the right channel without cracking his legs against one of the stone dividers. "Bug!" Jean cried, judging that the ruckus above would cover his own voice. "Your light! Slip it out, now! Locks in that cask!" Bug fumbled with his tunic, drew out a globe, and shook it. By the sudden flare of added white light, Jean could clearly see the outline of the bobbing black cask. He judged the distance between himself and it, came to a decision, and reached for one of his hatchets with his free hand. "Bug!" he yelled. "Don't try to get through the sides! Attack the flat top of the cask!"
"How?"
"Stay right where you are!" Jean leaned to his right, clinging to the rafter with his left arm. He raised the hatchet in his right hand, whispered a single "please" to whatever gods were listening, and let fly. The hatchet struck, quivering, in the dark wood of the cask. Bug flinched back, then splashed through the water to pry at the weapon. Jean began sliding his bulk along the rafter, but more dark motion in the corner of his eye brought him up short. He peered down into the shadows on his left. Something was moving across the surface of one of the other waterways in the damned maze. Several somethings, black scuttling shapes the size of dogs. their bristling legs spread wide when they slipped just beneath the surface of the dark water, then drew in to propel them up and over stone just as easily.
"Fuck me," he muttered. "Fuck me, that's not possible!"
Salt devils, despite their horrific size and aspect, were timid creatures. The huge spiders crouched in crevices on the rocky coasts to the southwest of Camor, preying on fish and gulls, occasionally falling prey to sharks or devilfish if they ventured too far from shore. Sailors flung stones and arrows at them with superstitious dread. Only a fool would approach one, with their fangs the length of a grown man's fingers, and their venom, which might not always bring death, but could make a man fervently pray for it. Yet salt devils were quite content to flee from humans. They were ambush hunters, solitary, incapable of tolerating one another at close quarters. Jean had scared himself witless in his early years reading the observations of scholars and naturalists concerning the creatures. Yet here was an entire pack of the damn things, leg to leg like hounds, scrabbling across stone and water alike toward Bug and the cask.
"Bug!" Jean screamed. "Bug!"
2. Bug had heard even less of the goings-on upstairs than Jean, yet when the cask had splashed down into darkness, he'd realized immediately that it hadn't been dropped down idly. Having placed himself directly over the canal that flowed from the waterfall, he'd simply let himself drop the 15 feet down into the rushing water. He'd tucked his legs and hit like a catapult stone, ass first. Although his head had plunged under with the momentum of his drop, he quickly found that he could plant his feet. The canal was only about 4 feet deep. Now, with Jean's hatchet gripped in one hand, he chopped frantically at the flat barrel top before him. He'd set his own light glass on the stone walkway beside the canal, as there was enough working light coming from Jean's beneath the surface of the water.
"Bug!"
the big man yelled, his voice suddenly loud with real alarm. "Bug!" The boy turned to his right and caught a glimpse of what was moving out of the far shadows toward him. A shudder of pure revulsion passed up and down his spine, and he looked around frantically to make sure the threat was approaching from only one direction.
"Bug, get out of the water! Get up on the stones!"
"What about Locke?"
"He doesn't want to come out of that cask right this fucking second!" Jean hollered. "Trust me!"
As Bug scrambled up out of the rippling, alchemically lit water, the cask began once again bobbing toward the south end of the building, where the canal exited to God's knew where. Too desperate to think clearly about his own safety, Jean scrambled out along the crossbeam, feet sliding in the muck of the ages, and ran in the direction of the waterfall with his arms windmilling crazily for balance. A few seconds later, he arrested his forward momentum by wrapping his arms around a vertical beam. His feet slipped briefly out from beneath him, but he clung tightly to his perch. His mad dash had brought him to a point beside the waterfall. Now he flung himself forward into the air, carefully drawing his legs into his chest. He hit the water with a splash as great as that caused by the cask and bumped the canal bottom. He came up sputtering, second hatchet already in hand. Bug was crouched on the stone lip beside the canal, waving his alchemical globe at the spiders. Jean saw that the salt devils were about 15 feet away from the boy, across the water and moving more warily, but still approaching. Their carapaces were mottled black and grey, their multiple eyes the colour of deepest night, starred with eerie reflections of Bug's light. Their hairy pedipalps waved in the air before their faces, and their hard black fangs twitched. 4 of the damn things. Jean heaved his bulk up out of the canal on Bug's side, spitting water. He fancied that he saw some of those inhuman black eyes turn to regard him.
"Jean!" Bug moaned. "Jean, those fucking things look pissed off!"
"It's not natural," said Jean as he ran to Bug's side.
The boy tossed him his other hatchet, and he caught it in the air. The spiders had closed to 10 feet, just across the water. He and Bug seemed hemmed in by 32 unblinking black eyes, 32 twitching legs with jagged dark hairs.
"Not natural at all. Salt devils don't act like this."
"Oh, good."
Bug held the alchemical globe out at arm's length, as though he could conceal himself entirely behind it. "You discuss it with them."
"I'm sure we can communicate. I speak fluent hatchet."
No sooner were these words out of Jean's mouth than the spiders moved in eerie unison, forward into the water with four splashes. The cask had now drifted a few feet to Jean and Bug's right. One black shape actually passed beneath it. Multiple black legs speared upward out of the water, flailing for purchase. Bug cried out in mingled disgust and horror. Jean lunged forward, striking out with each hatchet in rapid downward strokes. Two spider limbs opened with stomach-turning cracking noises, spurting dark blue blood. Jean leapt backward. The two uninjured spiders pulled themselves up out of the water a few seconds ahead of their wounded brethren and rushed Jean, their barbed feet rasping against the wet stone blocks beneath them. Realizing he would be dangerously overbalanced if he attempted to swing on both at once, Jean opted for a more disgusting plan of action. The wicked sister in his right hand arced downward viciously, splitting the rightmost salt devil's head between its symmetrical rows of black eyes. Its legs spasmed in its death reflex, and Bug actually dropped his alchemical globe, so quickly did he leap backward. Jean used the momentum of his right-hand swing to raise his left leg up off the ground. The left-hand spider reared up with its fangs spread, just as he brought his boot heel down on what he supposed was its face. Its eyes cracked like jellied fruit, and Jean shoved downward with all his might, feeling as though he was stomping on a sack of wet leathers. Warm blood soaked his boot as he pulled it free, and now the wounded spiders were scuttling up right behind their fallen counterparts, hissing and clicking in anger. One shoved its way in front of the other and lunged at Jean, legs wide, head up to bare its curving fangs. Jean brought both the sisters down in a hammer blow, blade sides reversed, smashing the spider's head down into the wet stones and stopping it in its tracks. Ichor spurted. Jean felt it spattering his neck and forehead, and did his best to ignore it. One damn monster left. Incensed at the delay they'd caused him, Jean bellowed and leapt into the air. Arms spread, he landed with both of his feet in the middle of the last creature's carapace. It exploded wetly beneath him, folding the flailing legs up at an unnatural angle. They beat their last few pulses of life against his legs as he ground in his heels, growling.
"Gah!"
cried Bug, who'd gotten a good soaking from something blue and previously circulating through a salt devil. Jean didn't waste a second in tossing the boy one of his gore-soaked sisters before jumping down into the water once again. The cask had floated about 10 feet farther south. Jean splashed frantically toward it and secured it with his left hand. Then he began to piston his right arm up and down, hacking at the wood of the barrel's cover with his hatchet.
"Bug!" he cried. "Kindly make sure there aren't any more of those damn things creeping up on us!"
There was a splash behind Jean as Bug hopped back into the waterway. A few seconds later the boy came up beside the cask and steadied it with his own thin arms.
"None that I can see, Jean. Hurry!"
"I am!" Crack, 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 fucking hurrying!
His hatchet blade bit through the wood at last. Horse urine poured out into the water, and Bug gagged. Working furiously, Jean widened the hole, then managed to pry off the end of the cask entirely. A wave of the foul, yellow-slick stuff swept out across his chest. Tossing his hatchet away without a further thought, he reached inside and tugged out the motionless body of Locke Lamora. Jean checked him frantically for cuts, slashes, or raised purple welts. His neck seemed to be quite intact. Jean heaved Locke rather urgently up onto the stone walkway beside the dead spiders, some parts of which were still twitching, then pushed himself up out of the water to crouch beside Locke. He wrenched off Locke's mantle and cloak. Bug appeared at his side just in time to yank them away and toss them in the water. Jean tore open Locke's grey vest and began thumping on his chest.
"Bug!" he gasped. "Bug! Get up here and push his legs in for me! His warm humours are all snuffed out. Let's get a rhythm going, and maybe we can rekindle them. Gods, if he lives, I swear I'll get 10 books on physic and memorize every single one."
Bug clambered out of the water and began pumping Locke's legs, moving them in and out one at a time, while Jean alternately pressed on Locke's stomach, pounded on his chest, and slapped him on the cheeks.
"Come on, gods damn it!" Jean muttered. "Be stubborn, you skinny little—"
Locke's back arched convulsively, and harsh, wet coughing noises exploded out of his throat. His hands scrabbled weakly at the stone, and he rolled over onto his left side. Jean sat back and sighed with relief, oblivious to the puddle of spider blood he'd settled into. Locke vomited into the water, retched and shuddered, then vomited again. Bug knelt beside him, steadying him by the shoulders. For several minutes, Locke lay there shaking, breathing heavily and coughing.
"Oh, gods,"
he said at last in a small, hoarse voice.
"Oh, gods, my eyes, I can barely see. Is there water?"
"Yes, running water." Jean reached over and took one of Locke's arms.
"Then get me in there. 13 gods, get this foulness off me."
Locke rolled into the canal with a splash before Jean or Bug could even move to assist him. He dunked his head beneath the dark stream several times, then began tearing off his remaining clothes until he was wearing nothing but a white undertunic and his grey breeches.
"Better?"
asked Jean.
"I suppose I must be,"
Locke retched again.
"My eyes sting, my nose and throat burn, my chest hurts, I've got a pounding black headache the size of Therim Pell. I got slapped around by the entire Barsavi family, I'm covered in horse piss, and it looks like the Grey King just did something pretty clever at our expense."
He set his head against the edge of the stone pathway and coughed a few more times. When he raised his head again, he noticed the spider carcasses for the first time and jerked backward.
"Ugh! Gods! Looks like there's things I've missed, too."
"Salt devils," said Jean. "A whole pack of them working together. They came on looking for a fight. Suicidal, like."
"That doesn't make any sense," said Locke.
"One thing could explain it," Jean replied.
"A conspiracy of the gods," Locke muttered.
"Oh, sorcery."
"Yes, that bloody bondsmage. If he can tame a scorpion hawk, he could—"
"But what if it's just this place?" interrupted Bug. "You've heard the stories."
"No need to fret about stories," said Locke, "when there's a live mage known to have it in for us. Jean's right. I didn't get stuffed in that barrel as a criticism of my play-acting, and those biting bitches weren't here for a rest holiday. You were both meant to be dead as well, or if not dead—"
"Scared off," said Jean. "Distracted. The better for you to drown."
"Seems plausible."
Locke rubbed at his stinging eyes once again.
"Amazing how every time I think my tolerance for this affair has reached a final low, I find something new to hate. Carlo and Galdo, we need to get to them."
"They could be in a world of shit," agreed Jean.
"They already are. But we'll face it better once we're back together."
Locke attempted to heave himself up out of the water and failed. Jean reached down and pulled him up by the collar of his tunic. Locke nodded his thanks and slowly stood up, shaking.
"I'm afraid my strength seems to have fled. I'm sorry, Jean."
"Don't be. You've taken a hell of a lot of abuse tonight. I'm just pleased we broke you out of that thing before it was too late."
"I'm indebted to the pair of you. Believe me, that was— it would have been—"
Locke shuddered and coughed again.
"It was pretty god's damned awful."
"I can only suppose," said Jean.
"Shall we go?"
"With all haste. Back out the way you two came in, quietly. Barsavi's crowd may still be in the area, and keep your eyes open for, birds."
"Too right. We came in through a sort of crawlway, western canal side." Jean slapped his forehead and looked around.
"Damn me, I've mislaid the sisters."
"Never fear," said Bug, holding them up. "I figured you'd want them back, so I kept a watch on them."
"Much obliged, Bug," said Jean. "I'm of a mind to use them on some people before this night is done." 3. Rustwater was as dead as ever when they snuck out the crawlway and scrabbled up onto the canal bank just to the west of the echo hole. Varsavi's procession had vanished, and although the three gentleman bastards crouched low and scanned the occulted sky for any hint of a swooping hawk, they caught not a glimpse.
"Let's make for Coal Smoke," said Locke. "Pass Beggar's Barrow. We can steal a boat and slip home through the culvert."
The drainage culvert on the south side of the temple district, just beneath the house of Perelandro, had a concealed slide mechanism within the cage that covered it from the outside. The gentleman bastards could open it at will to come and go quietly.
"Good idea," said Jean. "I'm not comfortable being about on the streets and bridges."
They crept south, grateful for the low, warm mists that swirled around them. Jean had his hatchets out and was moving his head from side to side, watchful as a cat on a swaying clothesline. He led them over a bridge, with Locke constantly stumbling and falling behind, then down the southeastern shore of the quiet. Here the lightless black heap of Beggar's Barrow loomed in the mists to their left, and the wet stink of paupers' graves filled the air.
"Not a watchman," whispered Locke. "Not a Shades Hill boy or girl. Not a soul. Even for this neighbourhood, that's damn peculiar."
"Has anything about tonight been right yet?"
Jean set as rapid a pace as he could, and they soon crossed another bridge, south into Coal Smoke. Locke laboured to keep up, clutching his aching stomach and ribs. Bug brought up their rear, constantly peering over his shoulder. On the northeastern edge of Coal Smoke there was a line of weathered docks, sagging stairs and crumbling stone quays. All the larger, nicer boats and barges were locked and chained, but a few small cockle shells bobbed here and there, secured by nothing more than rope. In a city full of such little boats, no sane thief would bother stealing one, most of the time. They clambered into the first one that chanced to have an oar. Locke collapsed at the stern while Bug took up the oar and Jean cast off the rope.
"Thank you, Bug."
Jean squeezed himself down into the wet bottom of the little wooden craft. All three of them made for a tight fit.
"I'll trade off with you in just a bit."
"What, no crack about my moral education?"
"Your moral education is over."
Jean stared up into the sky as the dockside receded and Bug took them out into the canal's heart.
"Now you're going to learn a thing or two about war."
4. Unseen and undisturbed, Jean quietly paddled them up against the north bank of the canal just south of their temple. The house of Perelandro was nothing more than a dark impression of mass, lightless in the silver fog above their heads.
"Smartly, smartly,"
the big man muttered to himself as he brought them abreast with the drainage culvert. It was about a yard up from the water, with an opening 5 feet in diameter. It led more or less directly to a concealed passage just behind the ladder that led down from the temple itself. Bug slipped a hand past the iron bars at the end of the culvert and tripped the hidden locking mechanism. He then prepared to climb in.
"I'll go first," he said,
just before Jean grabbed him by the collar.
"I think not. The wicked sisters will go first. You sit down and keep the boat steady."
Bug did so, pouting, and Locke smiled. Jean pulled himself up into the culvert and began crawling into the darkness.
"You can have the honour of going second, Bug," said Locke. "I might need a hand pulling me up."
When all three of them were wedged safely into the pipe, Locke turned and nudged the little boat back out into mid-canal with his feet. The current would carry it to the Via Camorazza, lost in the mists, until someone ran into it with a larger boat or claimed it as a windfall. Locke then slid the pipe cover closed and locked it once again. The gentleman bastards actually oiled the hinges on the grate to keep their comings and goings quiet. They crawled forward into blackness, surrounded by the gentle echoes of their own breathing and the soft noise of scuffing cloth. There was a quiet click as Jean operated the hidden entrance into the burrow, then a line of pale silver light spilled in. Jean stepped out onto the wooden floor of the dim passage. Just to his right, the rungs ran up into the hidden entrance beneath what had once been Father Chain's sleeping pallet. Despite Jean's best effort to move quietly, the floor creaked slightly as he moved forward.
Locke slipped out into the passage behind him, his heart pounding. The illumination was too dim. The walls had been golden for as long as he'd known the place. Jean crept forward, hatchets bobbing in his fists. At the far end of the passage, he whirled around the corner, crouched low, and then stood straight up, growling, "Shit!" The kitchen had been thoroughly trashed. The spice cabinets were overturned. Broken glass and shattered crockery littered the floor. The storage cupboards hung open, empty. The water barrel had been dumped on the tiles. The gilded chairs were torn apart, thrown into a heap in one corner. The beautiful chandelier that had swung above their heads for as long as any of them had lived within the glass burrow was a total ruin. It dangled now by a few wires, its planets and constellations smashed, its armillary paths bent beyond all possible repair. The sun that had burned at the heart of it all was cracked like an egg. The alchemical oils that had lit it from within had seeped onto the table. Locke and Jean stood at the edge of the entrance passage, staring in shock. Bug rounded the corner, hot for action against unseen foes, and came up short between them.
Gods! Gods!
Carlo! Locke abandoned all thoughts of sneaking about. Galdo! Carlo! Are you here? Jean swept aside the heavy curtain to the door that led to the wardrobe. He didn't say anything or make any noise, but the wicked sisters fell out of his hands and clattered against the floor tiles. The wardrobe, too, had been ransacked. All the rows of fine clothing and costume garments, all the hats and cravats and breeches and hose, all the waistcoats and vests and thousands of crowns' worth of accessories, all of it was gone. The mirrors were smashed. The mask box was overturned, its contents strewn and broken across the floor. Carlo and Galdo lay beside it, on their backs, staring upward in the semi-darkness. Their throats were slashed from ear to ear, a pair of smooth gashes, identical twin wounds. 5. Jean fell forward onto his knees. Bug tried to squeeze past Locke, and Locke shoved him back into the kitchen with all the feeble strength he could muster, saying,
"No, Bug, don't!"
But it was already too late. The boy sat down hard against the edge of the witchwood table and broke into sobs. "Gods," Locke thought as he stumbled past Jean into the wardrobe. "Gods, I have been a fool. We should have packed up and run."
"Locke,"
Jean whispered, and then he sprawled forward onto the ground, shaking and shuddering as though he were having some sort of fit. Locke crouched beside the bigger man and placed a hand beneath his round, heavy chin. Jean's pulse was pounding wildly. He looked up at Locke with wide eyes, his mouth opening and closing, failing to spit out words. Locke's mind raced. Poison? A trap of some sort? An alchemical trick left behind in the room? Why wasn't he affected? Did he feel so miserable already that the symptoms hadn't caught his attention yet? He glanced frantically around the room, and his eyes seized on a dark object that lay between the sprawled Sansa twins. A hand, a severed human hand, grey and dried and leathery. It lay with its palm toward the ceiling and its fingers curled tightly inward. A black thread had been used to sew a name into the dead skin of the palm. The script was crude, but nonetheless clear, for it was outlined with the faintest hint of pale blue fire. Jean Tannen.
"The things I could do to you if I were to stitch your true name."
The words of the falconer returned unbidden to Locke's memory. Jean groaned again. His back arched in pain, and Locke reached down toward the severed hand. A dozen plans whirled in his head. Chop it to bits with a hatchet, scald it on the alchemical hearth slab, throw it in the river. He had little knowledge of practical sorcery, but surely something was better than nothing. New footsteps crunched on the broken glass in the kitchen.
"Don't move, boy. I don't think your fat friend can help you at the moment." "That's it. Just sit right there."
Locke slid one of Jean's hatchets off the ground, placed it in his left hand, and stepped to the wardrobe door. A man was standing at the lip of the entrance hall, a complete stranger to Locke's eyes. He wore a long brownish-red oil cloak with the hood thrown back, revealing long, stringy black hair and drooping black moustaches. He held a crossbow in his right hand, almost casually, pointed at Bug. His eyes widened when Locke appeared in the wardrobe doorway.
"This ain't right," he said. "You're not supposed to be here."
"You're the Grey King's man," said Locke. His left hand was up against the back of the wall beside the door, as though he were holding himself up, concealing the hatchet.
"A Grey King's man. He's got a few."
"I will give you any price you name," said Locke. "Tell me where he is, what he's doing, and how I can avoid the bondsmage."
"You can't. I'll give you that one for free. And any price I name? You got no such pull."
"I have 45,000 full crowns."
"You did," said the crossbowman, amiably enough. "You don't any more."
"One bolt," said Locke. "Two of us." Jean groaned from the floor behind him. "The situation bears thinking on."
"You don't look so well, and the boy don't look like much. I said don't move, boy."
"One bolt won't be enough," said Bug, his eyes cold with an anger Locke had never before seen in him. "You have no idea who you're fucking with."
"One bolt," repeated Locke. "It was for Bug, wasn't it? If I weren't here, you'd have shot him first thing, then done for Jean. A commendable arrangement. But now there's two of us, and you're still armed for one."
"Easy, gents," said the Grey King's man. "I don't see either of you eager for a hole in the face."
"You don't know what you're up against, what we've done."
Bug flicked his wrist slightly, and something fell into it from his sleeve. Locke only barely caught the motion. What was that thing? An orphan's twist? Oh, gods, that wouldn't do any good against a crossbow quarrel.
"Bug," he muttered.
"Tell him, Locke. Tell him he doesn't know who he's fucking with. Tell him he doesn't know what he's going to get. We can take him."
"First one of you moves an inch, I let fly."
The crossbowman backed off a stride, braced his weapon with his left arm, and swung his aim back and forth between Locke and Bug.
"Bug, don't!" "We can take him, Locke, you and I. He can't stop both of us. Hell, I bet he can't stop either of us."
"Bug, listen."
"Listen to your friend, boy." The intruder was sweating nervously behind his weapon.
"I'm a gentleman bastard," said Bug slowly and angrily. "Nobody messes with us. Nobody gets the best of us. You're going to pay."
Bug sprang upward from the floor, raising the hand that held the orphan's twist, a look of absolute burning determination on his face. The crossbow snapped, and the whip crack of its unleashed cord echoed sharply from the enclosed glass walls of the kitchen. The bolt that was meant to catch Bug between the eyes took him in the neck instead. He jerked back as though stung by an insect. His knees buckled only halfway into his leap, and he spun backward, his useless little orphan's twist arcing out of his hands as he fell. The Grey King's man threw down his crossbow and reached for a blade at his belt, but Locke was preceded out the doorway by the hatchet he'd concealed, flung with all of his rage. Jean could have split the man's head with the blade. Locke barely managed to crack him hard with the ball side of the weapon, but it was enough. The ball caught him just beneath his right eye, and he flinched backward, crying out in pain. Locke scooped up the crossbow and fell upon the intruder, howling. He swung the buttstock of the weapon into the man's face, and the man's nose broke with a spray of blood. He fell backward, his head cracking against the elderglass of the passage wall. As he slid down, he raised his hands before him in an attempt to ward off Locke's next blow. Locke smashed his fingers with the crossbow. The screams of the two men mingled and echoed in the enclosed space. Locke ended the affair by slamming one curved end of the bow into the man's temple. The assassin's head spun, blood spattered against the glass, and he sagged into the passage corner, motionless. Locke threw down the crossbow, turned on his heel, and ran to Bug. The bolt had pierced the boy's neck to the right of his windpipe, toward the outer edge of his neck, where it was buried up to its rounded feathers in a spreading pool of dark blood. Locke knelt and cradled Bug's head in his hands, feeling the tip of the crossbow quarrel on the back of Bug's neck. Slick warmth poured out over Locke's hands. He could feel it coursing out with every ragged breath the boy took. Bug's eyes were wide, and they fixed on him.
"Forgive me," Locke mumbled through his tears. "God's damn me, Bug, this is my fault. We could have run. We should have. My pride. You and Carlo and Galdo. That bolt should have been me."
"Your pride," the boy whispered. "Justified. Gentleman. Bastard."
Locke pressed his fingers against Bug's wound, imagining he could somehow dam the flow of blood, but the boy cried out and Locke withdrew his shaking fingers.
"Justified!"
Bug spat. Blood ran out of the corner of his mouth.
"Am I not a second, not apprentice, real gentleman bastard?"
"You were never a second, Bug. You were never an apprentice."
Locke sobbed, tried to brush the boy's hair back, and was aghast at the bloody handprint he left on Bug's pale forehead.
"You brave little idiot! You brave, stupid little bastard! This is my fault, Bug. Please, please say this is all my fault."
"No,"
whispered Bug.
"Oh, God, hurts. Hurts so much."
The boy said nothing more. His breathing came to one last ragged halt while Locke held him. Locke stared upward. It seemed to him that the alien glass ceiling that had shed warm light on his life for so many long years now took a knowing pleasure in showing him nothing but dark red. The reflection of the floor on which he sat with the motionless body of Bug still bleeding in his arms. He might have stayed there, locked in a reverie of grief, for the gods only knew how long, but Jean groaned loudly in the next room. Locke remembered himself, shuddered, and set Bug's head down as gently as he could. He stumbled to his feet and lifted Jean's hatchet up off the ground once more. His motions were slow and unsteady as he walked back into the wardrobe, raised the hatchet above his head, and brought it down with all the force he could muster on the sorcerous hand that lay between the bodies of Carlo and Galdo. The faint blue fire dimmed as the hatchet blade bit down into the desiccated flesh. Jean gasped loudly behind him, which Locke took as an encouraging sign. Methodically, maliciously, he hacked the hand into smaller pieces. He chopped at leathery skin and brittle bones until the black threads that had spelled Jean's name were separated and the blue glow faded entirely. He stood staring down at the Sansas until he heard Jean moving behind him.
"Oh, Bug! Oh, God's damn it!"
The big man stumbled to his feet and groaned.
"Forgive me, Locke. I couldn't move."
"There's nothing to forgive."
Locke spoke as though the sound of his own voice pained him.
"It was a trap. It had your name on it, that thing the mage left for us. They guessed you'd be coming back."
A severed hand? A human hand with my name stitched into it?"
"Yes.
A hanged man's grasp,"
said Jean, staring at the fragments of flesh and at the bodies of the Sansas.
"I read about them when I was younger. Seems they work."
"Neatly removing you from the situation," said Locke coldly. "So one assassin hiding up above could come down, kill Bug, and finish you."
"Just one?"
"Just one,"
Locke sighed. "Jean, in the temple rooms up above, are lamp oil. Please fetch it down."
"Lamp oil?"
"All of it," said Locke. "Hurry."
Jean paused in the kitchen, knelt and slid Bug's eyes closed with his left hand. He buried his face in his hands and shook, making no noise. Then he stumbled back to his feet, wiping away tears, and ran off to carry out Locke's request. Locke walked slowly back into the kitchen, dragging the body of Carlo Sanza with him. He placed the corpse beside the table, folded its arms across its chest, knelt and kissed its forehead. The man in the corner moaned and moved his head. Locke kicked him once in the face, then returned to the wardrobe for Galdo's body. In short order, he had the Sanzas laid out neatly in the middle of the ransacked kitchen, with Bug beside them. Unable to bear the glassy stare of his dead friend's eyes, Locke covered them with silk tablecloths from a smashed cabinet.
"I promise you a death offering, brothers," Locke whispered when he'd finished. "I promise you an offering that will make the gods themselves take notice. An offering that will make the shades of all the dukes and coppers of Camor feel like paupers. An offering in blood and gold and fire. This I swear by Azaguia, who gathers us, and by Perelandro, who sheltered us, and by the crooked warden who places his finger on the scale when our souls are weighed. This I swear to Chains, who kept us safe. I beg your forgiveness that I failed to do the same."
Locke forced himself to stand up and return to work. A few old garments had been thrown into the wardrobe corners. Locke gathered them up, along with a few components from the spilled mask box, a handful of false moustaches, a bit of false beard, and some stage adhesive. These he threw into the entrance corridor to the burrow. Then he peeked into the vault. As he'd suspected, it was utterly empty. Not a single coin remained in any well or on any shelf. No doubt the sacks loaded onto the wagon earlier had vanished as well. From the sleeping quarters at the back of the burrow, he gathered sheets and blankets, then parchment, books, and scrolls. He threw these into a heap atop the dining room table. At last he stood over the Grey King's assassin, his hands and clothes covered in blood, and waited for Jean to return. 6. "Wake up," said Locke. "I know you can hear me." The Grey King's assassin blinked, spat blood, and tried to push himself even farther back into the corner with his feet. Locke stared down at him. It was a curious reversal of the natural way of things. The assassin was well-muscled, a head taller than Locke, and Locke was particularly unimposing after the events of this night. But everything frightening about him was concentrated in his eyes, and they bore down on the assassin with a bright, hard hatred. Jean stood a few paces behind him, a bag over his shoulder, his hatchets tucked into his belt. "Do you want to live?" asked Locke. The assassin said nothing. "It was a simple question, and I won't repeat it again. Do you want to live?"
Yes, the man said softly.
"Then it pleases me to deny you your preference." Locke knelt beside him, reached beneath his own undertunic, and drew forth a little leather pouch that hung by a cord around his neck. "Once," said Locke, "when I was old enough to understand what I'd done, I was ashamed to be a murderer. Even after I'd paid the debt, I still wore this. All these years to remind me." He pulled the pouch forward, snapping the cord. He opened it and removed a single small white shark's tooth. He grabbed the assassin's right hand, placed the pouch and the tooth on his palm, and then squeezed the man's broken fingers together around them. The assassin writhed and screamed. Locke punched him. "But now," he said, "now I'll be a murderer once again. I will set myself to slay until every last Grey King's man is gone. You hear me, cocksucker? I will have the bondsmage, and I will have the Grey King. And if all the powers of Camor and Carthane and hell itself oppose me, it will be nothing, nothing but a longer trail of corpses between me and your master."
"You're mad," the assassin whispered. "You'll never beat the Grey King."
"I'll do more than that. Whatever he's planning, I will unmake it. Whatever he desires, I will destroy it. Every reason you came down here to murder my friends will evaporate. Every Grey King's man will die for nothing, starting with you." Jean Tannon stepped forward and grabbed the assassin with one hand, hauling him to his knees. Jean dragged him into the kitchen, oblivious to the man's pleas for mercy.
The assassin was flung against the table, beside the three covered bodies and the pile of cloth and paper, and he became aware of the cloying smell of lamp oil. Without a word, Jean brought the ball of one of his hatchets down on the assassin's right knee. The man howled. Another swift crack shattered his left kneecap, and the assassin rolled over to shield himself from further blows, but none fell. "When you see the crooked warden," said Locke, twisting something in his hands, "tell him that Locke Lamora learns slowly, but he learns well. And when you see my friends, you tell them that there are more of you on the way." He opened his hands and let an object fall to the ground. It was a piece of knotted cord, charcoal grey, with white filaments jutting out from one end. Alchemical twist match. When the white threads were exposed to air for several moments, they would spark, igniting the heavier, longer-burning grey cord they were wrapped in. It splashed into the edge of a pool of lamp oil. Locke and Jean went up through the concealed hatch into the old stone temple, letting the ladder cover fall shut with a bang behind them. In the glass burrow beneath their feet, the flames began to rise. First the flames, and then the screams. Interlude. The Tale of the Old Handball Players. Handball is a Therin pastime, as cherished by the people of the southern city-states as it is scorned by the Vadrans in their kingdom to the north, although Vadrans in the south seem to love it well enough. Scholars belittle the idea that the game had its origin in the era of the Therin throne, when the mad emperor Satyrana would amuse himself by bowling with the severed heads of executed prisoners. They do not, however, deny it out of hand, for it is rarely wise to underestimate the Therin throne's excesses without the very firmest sort of proof. Handball is a rough sport for the rough classes, played between two teams on any reasonably flat surface that can be found. The ball itself is a rubbery mass of tree latex and leather, about 6 inches wide. The field is somewhere between 20 and 30 yards long, with straight lines marked, usually with chalk, at either end. Each team tries to move the ball across the other side's goal line. The ball must be held in both hands of a player as he runs, steps, or dives across the end of the field. The ball may be passed freely from player to player, but it must not be touched with any part of the body below the waist, and it must not be allowed to touch the ground, or possession will revert to the other team. A neutral adjudicator, referred to as the justice, attempts to enforce the rules at any given match, with varying degrees of success. Matches are sometimes played between teams representing entire neighborhoods or islands in Camor, and the drinking, wagering, and brawling surrounding these affairs always starts several days beforehand and ends when the match is but a memory. Indeed, the match is frequently an island of relative calm and goodwill in a sea of chaos. It is said that once, in the reign of the first Duke Andracana, a match was arranged between the cauldron and catchfire. One young fisherman, Marcos, was reckoned the finest handballer in the cauldron, while his closest friend, Gervain, was thought of as the best and fairest handball justice in the entire city. Naturally, the adjudication of the match was given over to Gervain. The match was held in one of the dusty, abandoned public squares of the Ashfall district, with 1,000 screaming, barely sober spectators from each side crowding the wrecked houses and alleys that surrounded the square. It was a bitter contest, close fought all the way. At the very end, the cauldron was behind by 1 point, with the final sands trickling out of the hourglass that kept the game's time. Marcos, bellowing madly, took the ball in his hands and bashed his way through an entire line of catchfire defenders. With one eye blackened, his hands bruised purple, blood streaming on his elbows and knees, he flung himself desperately for the goal line as the very last second of the game fell away. Marcos lay upon the stones, his arms at full extension, with the ball touching but not quite crossing the chalked line. Gervain pushed aside the crowding players, stared down at Marcos for a few seconds, and then said, "Not across the line. No point." The riot and the celebration that broke out afterward were indistinguishable from one another. Some say the Yellow Jackets killed a dozen men while battling it back. Others say it was closer to 100. At least 3 of the city's coppers died in a little war that broke out over reneged bets, and Marcos vowed never to speak to Gervain again. The two had fished together on the same boat since boyhood. Now the cauldron as a whole warned Gervain's entire family that their lives wouldn't be worth sausage casings if any one of them set foot in that district ever again. 20 years passed, 30, 35. The first Duke Nicovante rose to eminence in the city. Marcos and Gervain saw nothing of one another during this time. Gervain travelled to Jerez for many years, where he rowed galleys and hunted devilfish for pay. Eventually, homesick, he took passage for Camor. At the dockside he was astounded to see a man stepping off a little fishing boat, a man weathered and grey and bearded just like himself, but certainly none other than his old friend Marcos.
"Marcos!" he cried. "Marcos from the cauldron! Marcos! The gods are kind! Surely you remember me?"
Marcos turned to regard the traveller who stood before him. He stared for a few seconds. Then, without warning, he drew a long-bladed fisherman's knife from his belt and buried it, up to the hilt, in Gervain's stomach. As Gervain stared downward in shock, Marcos gave him a shove sideways, and the former handball justice fell into the water of Camor Bay, never to surface again.
"Not across the line, my ass!" Marcos spat.
Verari, Carthani, and Lashani nod knowingly when they hear this story. They assume it to be apocryphal, but it confirms something they claim to know in their hearts, that Camori are all God's damned crazy. Camori, on the other hand, regard it as a valuable reminder against procrastinating in matters of revenge, or, if one cannot take satisfaction immediately, on the virtue of having a long memory. Chapter 11. At the Court of Caparaza. 1. They had to steal another little boat, Locke having so profligately disposed of their first. On any other night, he would have had a good laugh. And so would Bug, and Carlo, and Galdo, he told himself. Locke and Jean drifted south between the Narrows and the Mara Camarazza, hunched over in old cloaks from the floor of the wardrobe, locked away from the rest of the city in the mist. The soft, flickering lights and murmuring voices in the distance seemed to Locke as artifacts of an alien life he'd left long ago, not elements of the city he'd lived in for as long as he could remember. "I'm such a fool," he muttered. He lay along a gunwale, aching, feeling the dry heaves rise up again from the battered pit of his stomach. "If you say that one more time," said Jean, "I will throw you into the water and row the boat over your head." "I should have let us run." "Perhaps," said Jean, "but perhaps not everything miserable that happens to us stems directly from one of your choices, brother. Perhaps bad things come regardless of what we do. Perhaps if we'd run, that bondsmage would have hunted us down upon the road and scattered our bones somewhere between here and Talisham. And yet... "We live," said Jean forcefully. "We live, and we may avenge them. You had the right idea when you did for that Grey King's man back in the burrow. The questions now are why and what next. Quit acting like you've been breathing wraithstone smoke. I need your wits, Locke. I need the Thorn of Camor."
"Let me know when you find him. He's a fucking fairy tale."
"No, he's sitting here in this boat with me. If you're not him now, you must become him. The Thorn is the man who can beat the Grey King. I can't do it alone, I know that much. Why would the Grey King do this to us? What does it bring him? Think, damn it!"
"Too much to guess at," said Locke. His voice regained a bit of its vigour as he pondered. "But narrow the question. Consider the means. We saw one of his men beneath the temple. I saw another man when I was taken for the first time. So we know he had at least 2 working for him, in addition to the bondsmage."
"Right. Does he strike you as a sloppy operator?"
"No." Locke rubbed his hands together. "No,
Everything he did seemed to me to be as intricate as Ferrari clockwork. Yet he sent only one man down into the burrow. Yes, the Sanzas were already dead. I was thought to be dead. You walked into another trap set by the bondsmage, and it would have been a crossbow quarrel for Bug. Deftly done, quick and cruel. But why not send two men? Why not three? To bury us so viciously, why not be absolutely sure of the issue? Jean gave the water a few gentle strokes to hold their position against the current. I cannot believe he suddenly became lazy at the very culmination of his scheme. Perhaps, said Locke, perhaps he needed what other men he had elsewhere very badly. Perhaps one was all he could spare. Locke gasped and slammed his right fist into the open palm of his left hand. Perhaps we weren't the culmination of his scheme after all. What then? Not what, who? Locke sat up and groaned, his head swimming. Who has he been attacking all these months? Jean, Barsavi believes the Grey King to be dead. So now what will he do tonight? He'll throw a revel. Just like he used to do on the Day of Changes. He'll celebrate. At the floating grave, said Locke. He'll throw the doors open, haul in casks. God's real ones this time. He'll summon his whole court, all the right people, drunk three deep along the causeway and the wharfs of the Wooden Waste, just like the good old days. So the Grey King faked his own death to lure Barsavi into throwing a revel? It's not the revel, said Locke. It's the people. All the right people. That's it. Gods, that's it. Barsavi will appear before his people tonight for the first time in months. Do you understand? All the gangs, all the garistas will witness anything that happens there. Which does what for the Grey King? The fucker has a flair for the dramatic. I'd say Barsavi's in a heap of shit. Rojan. Get me down to the cauldron right now. I can cross to the waste myself. I need to be at the floating grave with haste. Have you lost your mind? If the Grey King and his men are still prowling, they'll kill you for sure. And if Barsavi sees you, you're supposed to be nearly dead of a stomach flux. You are nearly dead of more than that. They won't see Locke Lamora, said Locke, fumbling with some of the items he'd managed to salvage from the mask box. He held a false beard up to his chin and grinned. My hair's going to be grey for a few days, since the removal salve is burning up as we speak. I'll throw on some soot and put up the hood, and I'll be just another skinny nobody with bruises all over his face come looking for some free wine from the cuppa. You should rest. You've had your life damn near pounded out of you. You're a complete mess. I ache in places I didn't previously realize I owned, said Locke, gingerly applying adhesive paste to his chin with his fingers. But it can't be helped. This is all the disguise gear we have left. We've got no money, no wardrobe, no more temple, no more friends. And you only have a few hours at best to go to ground and find us a place to stay before the Grey King's men realize one of their number is missing. But still, I'm half your size, Jean. You can't pamper me now. I can go unseen. You'll be obvious as the rising sun. My suggestion is that you find a hovel in Ashfall, clear out the rats, and leave some of our signs in the area. Just scrawl soot on the walls. I'll find you when I'm done. But, Jean, you wanted the Thorn of Camor. Well, you've got him. Locke jammed the false beard onto his chin and pressed until the adhesive ceased tingling, letting him know that it was dry. Take me to the cauldron and let me off. For Carlo, Galdo, and Bug, if not for me. Something's about to happen at the floating grave, and I need to see what it is. Everything that bastard has done to us comes down to the next few hours, if it isn't happening already. 2. It could be said, with several levels of truthful meaning, that when Carlo Barsavi outdid himself with a celebration for his victory over the murderer of his daughter. The floating grave was thrown open. The guards remained at their posts, but discipline slackened agreeably. Huge alchemical lanterns were hauled up under the silk awnings on the topmost decks of the harbour-locked galleon. They lit up the wooden waste beneath the dark sky and shone like beacons through the fog. Runners were sent out to the last mistake for food and wine. The tavern was rapidly emptied of all its edibles, most of its casks, and every single one of its patrons. They streamed toward the wooden waste, drunk or sober, united in curious expectation. The guards on the quay eyed the guests pouring in, but did little else. Men and women without obvious weapons concealed beneath their clothes were passed through without so much as a cursory search. Flush with victory, the copper had decided to be magnanimous in more ways than one. This was to Locke's benefit. Hooded and bearded and thoroughly begrimed, he slipped in with a huge crowd of cauldron cutthroats making their rowdy way across the walkway to Barsavi's galleon, lit like a pleasure galley from some romantic tale of the pashas of the Bronze Sea. The floating grave was packed with men and women. Kappa Barsavi sat on his raised chair, surrounded by all of his inner circle, his red-faced, shouting sons, his most powerful surviving garistas, his quiet, watchful Barangius twins. Locke had to push and shove and utter curses to make his way into the heart of the fortress. He nudged himself into a corner near the main doors to the ballroom, and watched the affair from this position, aching and uncomfortable, but grateful just to be able to claim a vantage point. The balconies were spilling over with toughs from all the gangs and Camorre. The rowdiness was growing by the minute. The heat was incredible, and the smell. Locke felt pressed against the wall by the weight of odours, wet wool and sweated through cotton, wine and wine breath, hair oils and leather. It was just past the first hour of the morning when Barsavi suddenly rose from his chair and held up a single hand. Attentiveness spread outward like a wave. Right people nudged one another into silence and pointed to the kappa. It took less than a minute for the echoing chaos of the celebration to peter down to a soft murmur. Barsavi nodded appreciatively.
"I trust we're enjoying ourselves."
There was a general outburst of cheers, applause, and foot stomping. Locke privately wondered how wise that really was in a ship of any sort. He was careful to applaud along with the crowd.
"Feels marvelous to be out from under a cloud, doesn't it?"
Another cheer. Locke scratched at his temporary beard, now damp with sweat. There was a sudden sharp pain in his stomach, right where one of the younger Barsavis had given him particular consideration with a fist. The heat and the smell were triggering strange, tickly feelings of nausea in the back of his throat, and he'd had enough of that particular sensation to last the rest of his life. Sourly, he coughed into his hands and prayed for just a few more hours of strength. One of the Barangius sisters stepped over beside the kappa, her shark's teeth bangles shining in the light of the hall's chandeliers, and whispered into his ear. He listened for a few seconds, and then he smiled.
"Sherin," he shouted, "proposes that I allow her and her sister to entertain us. Shall I?"
The answering cheer was twice as forceful, and twice as genuine to Locke's ears, as anything yet heard. The wooden walls reverberated with it, and Locke flinched.
"Let's have a teeth show, then!"
All was chaos for the next few minutes. Dozens of Barsavi's people pushed revelers back, clearing an area at the center of the floor about 10 yards on a side. Revelers were pressed up the stairs until the balconies creaked beneath their weight. Observation holes were cranked open so those on the top deck could peer down at the proceedings. Locke was pushed back into his corner more firmly than ever. Men with hooked poles drew up the wooden panels of the floor, revealing the dark water of Camorre Bay. A thrill of anticipation and alarm passed through the crowd at the thought of what might be swimming down there. The unquiet spirits of 8 full crowns, for one thing, thought Locke. As the final panels in the center of the opening square were removed, almost everyone present could see the little support platforms on which they'd rested, not one wider than a man's handspread. They were spaced about 5 feet apart, Barsavi's arena for his own private teeth shows, a challenge for any contrarechiala, even a pair as experienced as the Barangius sisters. Sherin and Raisa, old hands at teasing a crowd, were stripping out of their leather doublets, braces, and collars. They took their graceful time while the cuppers subjugated